Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Great Plague, A People's History, by Evelyn Lord, narrated by Jennifer M. Dixon. Preface. In the 1990s, I was the lecturer in local history at one of the newer universities. Part of the students' program was to research and write a third-year dissertation on a subject of their own choosing. One of the mature students chose to write on a 17th-century village in the Peak District, matching up houses and families through probate material and other local sources. When the dissertation was completed and handed in, her husband found her in tears, and on being asked what was the matter, she replied, "They're all dead now," they being her dissertation families. When her husband pointed out that they had been dead for hundreds of years, she replied, "But they were alive to me." This is one of the aims of local history, to bring the ordinary people of the past alive, and as Helen Cam perceptively wrote in 1944, the local historian starts from a present-day objective reality. Whether building, boundary, name, or custom, he holds the live end of an unbroken thread running back into the past. As a thread attached to relatively small geographical areas or communities, microhistory can provide much valuable information on the macro questions of life, work, and death. This book aims to follow the thread of history to Cambridge and the long hot summers of 1665 and 1666 in order to bring the people who lived and died at that time alive and record their lives, experiences, and deaths for the present day. Over the last few years, a different way of presenting history has emerged, which sheds a new perspective on the past. This tells the story through sources, but invents situations and dialogue, and employs techniques reminiscent of docudrama. This method, sometimes called faction, was used to good effect by Professor Hatcher in his book on the Black Death, and robustly defended by him in an article in History. It is a method that I have used often in the past when teaching mature adult education students by taking on the persona of a historical character, for example, or by covering an event as prosaic as life in the medieval village and telling a story, but ending the session by explaining how the story was compiled and the sources used to do this. Thus, some of the scenes and descriptions in this book are imagined, but based on the sources. The sources used for the discovery of Cambridge life in 1665 and 1666 are detailed in the appendix. Why has Cambridge been chosen as the place for this exploration of the past? Cambridge in 1665 was a town settling down after the Civil War, which had caused tension between a mainly royalist university and a mainly parliamentarian town, and the restoration of Charles II in 1660, which had resulted in a purge of the town's corporation and reprisals against college fellows who had supported Parliament. In 1665, the town and university looked forward to a settled and economically fruitful existence in which the town's feasts and fairs could be celebrated, and couples could marry and raise children in peace. But over this optimism hung the spectre of the plague. The effect of the Great Plague of 1665 and 1666 on London is well known. Many books have been written about it, most of them based on the Bills of Mortality, which listed the numbers of people who died each week and how many of these died from plague. Cambridge issued bills of mortality as well, and although the percentage of plague deaths was high, Cambridge was much smaller than London, so that by using other sources, it is possible to identify where the plague victims lived and to reconstruct their lives, and so produce an intimate picture of Cambridge in a time of crisis. 17th-century Cambridge was a town of overlapping communities that symbiotically meshed together. The colleges and the university, the town corporation, shopkeepers, craftsmen, labourers, and the poor. This allows for the examination of many different people's experience of the plague, for example, that of the college fellow and the college servant, a wealthy alderman and an impoverished locksmith, the middle-aged prostitute or the fishmonger's wife, a family of weavers and a family of orphans. In contrast to the approach taken by Keith Wrightson, who was attracted to write about the 1636 plague in Newcastle upon Tyne by the documents penned by one person, many sources have been used in the research for this book. This is one of the advantages of working in Cambridge, as sources relevant to the 1665 plague can be found in the Cambridgeshire Archives, the Cambridgeshire Collection, Cambridge University Library and College Archives. Another advantage is that the layout of the streets in central Cambridge is the same as it was in 1665, and many of the houses where plague victims lived still exist. Chapter 1. The Black Horse of the Apocalypse and Its Pale Rider. On the 25th of July, 1665, 5-year-old John Morley of Holy Trinity Parish in Cambridge died. On his chest were found black spots, tokens of the plague. His little brother, who had sat on a stool round-eyed and fearful, watching him, also had spots on his face. He was swept from his mother's arms by men dressed in white robes and taken away. He died in the pest house on the 5th of August, 1665, and the distraught parents were shut up in their house with a red cross painted on the door, and the words, "Lord, have mercy on us," written below it. In Cambridge, the nightmare had begun. Although the inhabitants of Cambridge might have basked in the summer sun of 1665, at the back of their minds was the unspoken fear of plague, a pestilence that spread through a community like wildfire as the black horse of the apocalypse with its pale rider picked off its victims. People died from painful tumours in the armpit and groin, from deadly fevers and blood poisoning. There was no known cure, and many saw the pestilence as heralding the end of the world, as towns and villages were deserted and the dead lay in the streets with no one left to bury them. The Black Death, as it later became known, was first seen in England in July 1348, when a ship carrying infected sailors docked at Malcolm Regis in Dorset. By April 1349, the plague was in Cambridge, but by 1350, plague deaths ceased, and the country breathed a collective sigh of relief. The crisis was over, and life could get back to normal, or as normal as it could be when houses stood empty, fields lay untilled, there were gaps in the tavern, and familiar faces missing from the pumps where women met to draw water and do their washing. In Cambridge, work started on 3 new colleges to train men for the priesthood and replace those who had died in the plague. Bishop Bateman of Norwich founded Trinity Hall and completed Gonville Hall, and in 1352, Corpus Christi College was founded by the town's guilds and their patron, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster. For a time, there was full employment in the town. More scholars arrived at the university, there was enough food for everyone, and widows and widowers, agreeing that it was better to share life, remarried. This time of reconstruction was not to last, however, and the plague returned to the town in 1361. It was to reappear in every century of the millennium. In 1447, Henry VI cancelled a visit to Cambridge to lay the foundation stone of King's College because of the air of pestilence which has long reigned in our said university. And in 1511, the humanist scholar Erasmus left London because of the plague and was trapped in Cambridge until 1513, in the midst of pestilence and hemmed in by robbers. When plague appeared in the town, the university suspended lectures and sent the students away. Stourbridge Fair, held on the outskirts of Cambridge, was cancelled by royal proclamation. All entertainment was banned, and the social and economic life of the town was severely disrupted. In the 17th century, if rumours of plague in London reached Cambridge, the town tried to isolate itself and forbade all contact with the capital. On the 9th of July, 1625, Mr. Mead of Christ's College, Cambridge, wrote to Sir Martin Stutfill in London, "It grows very dangerous on both sides to continue an intercourse by letter, not knowing what hands they pass through. Our Hobson and others have been forbidden to go to London." He added, "Blessed be to God we are yet well at Cambridge." He was too optimistic. On the 28th of August, 1625, the mayor's feast was cancelled because of the plague, and on the 20th of October, all sermons and public assemblies were banned. The Hobson mentioned in the letter was Thomas Hobson, the university carrier, livery stable-keeper, town benefactor, and one of 17th-century Cambridge's more colourful characters. This is the Hobson of Hobson's Choice, taken from his practice of hiring out his horses in strict rotation and not allowing his customers to choose, regardless of whether the next horse on the rota was an elderly nag or a spirited young blood, too frisky for the customer to control. Thomas Hobson took over the carrier's business in 1568 and soon proved to be an adept businessman, expanding the business so that a fleet of his carts carried goods, passengers, letters and packages, as well as the university's mail and parcels between Cambridge and London. As his business grew, so did his wealth, and he began to invest in property in Cambridge and in the surrounding countryside, including Anglesey Abbey and land in Cottenham and Waterbeach. In 1628, he conveyed land in St. Andrew's Street in Cambridge to the town and the university, and provided money to build and equip a workhouse for poor women, which became known as the Spinning House. He also paid for a conduit into the marketplace, into which pure spring water flowed from Trumpington Nine Wells. This was part of a scheme jointly designed by the town and the university to have a flow of fresh water through the streets to cleanse the town and, it was hoped, prevent further outbreaks of disease. The flow of water can still be seen in Trumpington Street, but the conduit has been moved to the corner of Trumpington Street and Lensfield Road. Hobson died during the plague outbreak, but not of the plague. The poet John Milton, who was studying at Christ's College at the time, thought it was because Hobson could not stand the inaction when forbidden to travel to London, and dedicated a poem to him. On the university carrier who sickened in the time of his vacancy, being forbid to go to London by reason of the plague. Prior to 1665, the worst outbreak of plague Cambridge had experienced occurred in 1630 and 1631. This was within living memory of many people living in Cambridge in 1665, and others had been told about it by their parents or grandparents. Alderman Samuel Newton of Cambridge, who was to keep a diary from 1662 to 1717, was aged 5 during the 1630 outbreak, and in his late teens during the plagues of 1642 and 1646, so he could remember what it was like to live in a town where pestilence stalked the streets. It was not surprising that, having endured 1665, when plague returned to the town in 1666, he upped sticks and moved his family to Waterbeach in the countryside. Others heard of it from their parents or grandparents. They were told how people starved because the country folk were too frightened to bring their produce into town, and how daily hundreds of people trooped out of the town to the fields to find grain. They were told how the university's vice-chancellor, Dr. Butts, tried to help the infected sick and the poor, giving them money and employing a German physician to minister to the sick in the pest house, and provided bedding and firing from his own purse. They were told how by May 1630 at least 222 people had died of the plague, and there were nearly 3,000 people on poor relief. Children were told by their grandparents how, when all hope was lost, a letter was read out in all the parish churches in England asking for a collection to be made for the destitute poor of Cambridge, and money poured in from cities, towns, and villages. It came from communities stricken with the plague themselves. £20 from Leicester, £100 from the county of Essex, £57 from St. Neots. Even tiny villages sent as much as they could afford, and eventually £2,739.7 and 4 was collected, over £200,000 in today's money. The corporation began to disperse this in March 1631, and the crisis was over. The town had survived one of its worst periods, and it was to survive further outbreaks of the plague in 1637 and 1638, and again in 1642 and 1646, when Cambridge was a garrison town during the Civil War. Then the plague appeared to cease, but by the 1660s there was a notion among the common people that the plague visited every 20 years and must return. Henry Moore, a tutor at Christ College, Cambridge, wrote to Lady Conway on the 4th of January, 1663, "And I am afraid a great mortality is coming upon these nations. The weather here is as if it were April or May for warmth. Primroses and violets have been abloom a good while. The birds sing as in spring in the orchard. I believe we shall have an ill after-reckoning of all this mirth. There have been many fiery meteors seen, several rivers and wells dried, which show that there have been considerable changes in the entrails of the earth. I wish these things be not forerunners of some greater mortality." Astrologers predicted the plague's reappearance because of the conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter in Sagittarius on the 9th of October 1664, and between Mars and Saturn on the 12th of November. Astrological predictions were confirmed on the 12th of November 1664 by the appearance of a harbinger of doom, a comet. Samuel Newton saw the comet in Cambridge on the 17th of December 1664. The same day in the morning, from about 2 o'clock to 5 in the morning, was seen in the air a comet, which several days latterly has also been seen. The star itself was very little, or not at all bigger than an ordinary star. It had a ray which appeared, in the judgment of some, to be 20 yards in length, to others the length of a pike, to others the length of King's College Chapel. It appeared south-eastwards. He saw the comet again on the 3rd of April 1665, at 3 in the morning, as he was rising early to go to Hog's Hill. Some thought that a visitation from the plague was a stroke of God's wrath for the sins of mankind, and a broom to sweep the kingdom clean. It was no accident that some of the symptoms of the plague resembled those of venereal disease, the mark of a dissolute life and corrupt society, where sexual excess and depravity were common. Others thought that a dose of the clap could be a preventive against the plague, and went out of their way to catch it. The most popular theory on the cause of the plague was miasma, the earth belching forth venomous vapours. Vapours caused by filth, overcrowding, dunghills, excrement, stinking standing water, putrefying churchyards, all polluting the air. The vapours could lie dormant in the soil during cold weather and resurface when it became warmer. This was borne out by the patterns of plague deaths, which decreased in the winter, only to occur in greater numbers in the summer. The idea that bad air could cause disease persisted into the 19th century, but we now know that plague was caused by a bacillus, Yersinia pestis, identified by Dr. Alexandre Yersin in 1894. Helped by the new science of bacteriology, he found that the bacillus that caused plague was primarily a disease of rats. 4 years later, P. Simon recognised that the disease spread to humans through the bite of a rat flea. he found that once the rat host died, the infected flea left to find another warm body to feed on, but as it could not ingest any blood, when it bit the human, it injected the lethal bacillus under the skin. Plague was transmitted from flea bites rather than from human to human. However, a secondary infection of the lungs, or pneumonic plague, could be spread from human to human by droplets. This was the type of plague referred to in the nursery rhyme, Ring-a-ring-a-roses. The 1665-1666 outbreak was almost certainly bubonic plague. William Boghurst records from his observations of plague victims that there was little of the sneezing that there had been in other countries and other times. There was no known cure for the scourge, but the medical profession had many preventive measures that could be used. That august body, the College of Physicians, suggested that prevention of the plague started with prayer and repentance, and, if it became necessary to go out into the streets, tobacco, rue, or angelica should be chewed, and clothes should be perfumed with juniper or cedar wood. Pomanders should be hung around the neck. The college helpfully gave two recipes, one for the poor and one for the rich. The pomander for the poor was made of rue, zeddery, turmeric, myrrh, 2 grains of camphor, and 2 grains of laudanum put into a cloth bundle. The richer sort's pomander included citron pills, angelica seeds, zeddery, rose leaves, aloes, 5 grains of laudanum, and 5 drams of gum dissolved in rose water and enclosed in an ivory box to be hung on a golden chain. Oranges studded with cloves tended to be a more temporary solution. The college also published a selection of diets that could be used as a preventive. These ranged from fasting to eating a great deal of garlic cooked in butter with bread and sage or summer sorrel. London, or Venetian treacle, was considered especially beneficial. This was not treacle as we know it, but a compound of 75 ingredients, each added with great ceremony, and the result taken as a pill. Non-medical practitioners had their own recipes. Hannah Glass prescribed plague water. This was an infusion of rue, sage, mint, rosemary, wormwood, and lavender in a gallon of wine, which was put into a pot and left to warm in ashes for 4 or 5 days, then strained and bottled with camphor. It could be taken by mouth, rubbed on the loins or the temple, or sniffed up. A similar recipe appears in the recipe book of the Barnardistons, a family of apothecaries in Bury St. Edmunds. They boiled rue and sugar in muscadine wine and added nutmeg, pepper, treacle, and angelica water. 1/2 spoonful was to be taken in the morning and 1/2 in the evening, and then trust in God. When plague was identified, the Privy Council swung into action and issued a series of orders to county sheriffs and town councils. The first set of directives was concerned with stopping the infection from spreading, banning all public meetings, and cancelling fairs, including Cambridge's Stourbridge Fair. The next order stated that all streets and alleys were to be thoroughly cleansed, and fires strewn with sweet herbs were to burn on street corners. No dogs, cats, or tame pigeons were allowed out on the streets, and some authorities went so far as to kill all dogs, cats, and pigeons in their town. Infected households were to be closed up, or the inhabitants sent to a pest house. Wardens were to be appointed to watch infected houses and supply necessities, and searchers were to be appointed to identify plague victims. Lastly, there were to be monthly fasts, public prayers every Wednesday and Friday, and collections made in churches for the infected poor, by which means God may be inclined to remove his severe hand from amongst you and us. Towns took these orders seriously, and isolated the infected poor in pest houses, which at first were hastily erected sheds, where the dead and the dying were close neighbours, but later were purpose-built structures. There were 4 pest houses in Cambridge, at Ball's Folly, Gonville Place, Midsummer Common, Jesus Green, and the largest at Coldham Common, on the eastern outskirts of the town. The pest houses were often left to decay on the site, but in April 1658 the university and town agreed that in case the town should be visited by sickness again, they would be prepared by building timber cabins on commons and waste places in the town at their joint expense. These would follow the pattern of the sheds built on Coldham Common, consisting of two timber frames with six lodging rooms, and in every room a brick chimney and an iron bar to hang pots from. The external walls were to be of brick, 2.5 yards high, well covered with tiles and sealed with hair mortar, and the rooms to be paved with brick. Each room was to have a door with a lock and windows with wooden shutters. There was to be separate accommodation for overseers and watchers. The cost of building these came to £189, 1 shilling and 9 pence halfpenny. Despite this building programme, on the 22nd of November 1663, the corporation noted that many of the pest houses were in bad condition and would deteriorate further unless they were properly repaired. Few survived the move to a pest house, and contemporaries thought it a slaughterhouse for mankind. This is what the inhabitants of Cambridge had to look forward to in 1665, a disease without any known cure which could spread like wildfire through the town, and a painful death, either shut up in their own houses with the dead and dying, or locked in a pest house. Chapter 2. Fine Buildings and Bad Smells. In September 1654, the diarist and gardener John Evelyn rode into Cambridge from Huntingdon. He came along the old Roman road, through Fenstanton, across the fens with the church towers of Lulworth and Fen Drayton in the distance, through the fields of Girton, and across the west fields of Cambridge with their stubble after the harvest and before the winter ploughing. He rode past the Civil War bastions defending Cambridge Castle and past the castle mound. Here an unpleasant smell assailed him from one of the common dunghills situated in a valley behind the castle. On his left was the parish church of St. Giles, and on his right St. Peter's Parish, with its fish ponds and willows. He rode past Magdalen College and across the great bridge over the Cam, which gives the town its name. The ducking stool for scolds hung from this bridge, suspended over the river by a pulley on a beam. The back of the stool, which faced the road, was engraved and painted with devils laying hold of scolds. Visitors from London, such as Samuel Pepys, entered the town through flat, open fenland grazed by cattle and sheep, and, like St. Peter's Parish, heavily fringed with willows. Willows were an important cash crop in Cambridge, and a map of 1688 by David Logan shows every watercourse and every road shaded by them, with at least 200 stands of these trees on Cofen and St. Thomas Leys. Celia Fiennes, who visited the town in 1685, described it as garnished with willows. Visitors from east came into Cambridge from the Gog Magog hills, the highest point overlooking the town. On a clear day, King's College Chapel and Ely Cathedral could be seen from the hills, but when Daniel Defoe rode to Cambridge, the Isle of Ely looked as if wrapped in blankets and nothing to be seen. Each entrance to the town was marked by a common dunghill, as well as at the castle. Others stood at the country end of Jesus Lane, at Spittle End on the Trompington Road, and in the west close to Newnham Mill and the ancient house known as the Hermitage. Household waste, manure, rotting vegetation, and dead dogs and cats were deposited on the dunghills, and the stench from these mingled with the smell of blood from Fair Lane and Slaughterhouse Lane, where the butchers went about their business. Even more pungent and obvious was the odour from Robert Atkinson's scalding house, where hair and fibres were scalded off animals' bodies. It was not the smell of the town that visitors commented on, but the air. John Evelyn described it as thick, infested by the fens, and William Schellink, a Dutchman travelling in England between 1661 and 1663, wrote, "There is nothing lacking but better air, which because of the vapours from boglands is somewhat unhealthy, especially in summer when it is heavy and murky."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?